arthritis, to transition more effectively from a pediatric to an adult-based healthcare system, and he will be leading an NIH grant to develop and test an online intervention to improve HIV medication adherence among HIV-positive adults. And as I said before, he's co-authored many papers and presentations. And we thank you so much for presenting. Okay. All right. All right, now I'd like
to... And I left my water up there, so I might have to grab that.
Yes, it's down. We'll pass that down to you. Okay. Now I'd like to introduce Mr. George Weiss, who is the project coordinator for the Healthy Young Men's Study and is the division administrator for the Division of Research on Children, Youth, and Families of Children's Hospital of Louisiana. Oh, I'm sorry. It's L.A. period. Okay, we'll move you on. And in your programs, I believe we had Dr. Michelle Kipke was scheduled to speak, and Mr. Weiss is going to speak in her place. Thank you.
Thanks. Hi there. So I'm going to speak a little bit about HIV risk among Latino young men who have sex with men. Let's see. Oh, there we go. I also have no relationships to disclose. So let's just take a moment and think about Latino YMSM and HIV risk. What I'm going to share is some of this is based on the literature that's around Latino young men who have sex with men, but it also includes some of the findings for older Latino MSM, because there really is very limited amounts of research that has looked specifically at this population. We do know that HIV rates among emerging adult young men who have sex with men continue to rise, particularly among young men of color, particularly like African-American or Latino young men. Concepts like connectedness, particularly to community, family, and or friends, have been found to actually be associated, I meant to write, with protection or with protective behaviors, and having really strong protective effects for Latino men. We've seen for MSM, and particularly YMSM, strong relationships between drug use and HIV transmission. Particularly in the experience of emerging to adulthood, this transition from being a late adolescent to a young adult can bring a range of different life stressors, including finding one's own employment, navigating school. There can be additional stressors for a young man who has sex with men, around integration of identity. And so this can be certainly an exciting time, but also a very stressful time for some people. And we know well that there are certainly our ethnic cultural differences that influence risk for different populations. And that's the reason for a presentation like the one we're having today. Presenting data that comes from the Healthy Young Men Study. This was a 5-year longitudinal study funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Our goal was to examine HIV risk and prevention among YMSM within a developmental period called emerging adulthood. There was a broad focus on individual, familial, peer, and sexual partner risk and protective factors associated with both drug use and HIV risk behaviors. We asked them a lot of questions. We did a baseline and follow-up interviews every 6 months for 2 years. And we used a mixed method design, which included qualitative formative work, as well as targeted qualitative sub-studies with sub-samples of the longitudinal cohort. We looked at constructs like religiosity, as well as racism and homophobia, and how these young men might have viewed those and experienced those in their life. And we really benefited from a strong bi-directional community partnership. We had community partners that were involved throughout the duration of the study, from the beginning, during the design of the actual survey and qualitative data collection guides, as well as through our process of reviewing those findings and their implications. So we need to get that? Yep. Got it? All right. Okay. We used a venue-based randomized probability sampling design, which is similar to the Young Men's Study, as well as City Project. We stratified by 3 racial ethnic groups. There was white, African American, Latino of Mexican descent. We initially wanted to include a sample of API young men of Filipino descent, but during our formative phase found that there were too few Filipino young men who were 18 to 22 that would be in these venues. And through discussions with our community advisory board, we launched separate studies with API young men using different recruitment methodologies. The survey that was administered was using a CASI, which included both self-administered and as well as interviewer-administered. The self-administered sections were those sections that were around sexual behavior and drug use, where more social desirability bias could be introduced. We are really excited that we were able to retain 93% across the 2 years. Today's presentation is going to specifically focus on the Latino of Mexican descent cohort. I'll be presenting some descriptives from the baseline as well as the 2-year follow-up, and then some analysis that was done with the baseline data. So let's look at our group. Here's some of the demographic descriptions for both the baseline and the Wave 5 sample. It is interesting to note that you had over 70% that were living at home at baseline. This was actually higher than the general sample, which was 54%, and not surprising, of course, that many moved out from their home during the course of the study. It's also not surprising to see that more and more of them move from not being in school and being employed only. You can see that you can see a little bit of an increase in those who are endorsing a gay identity across the time, as well as those who might have reported being sexually attracted only to men. I include both because certainly identity and attraction are really fluid during this period of one's life. Was interested to look at HIV testing. I wanted to share that because, like many other areas, there was an enormous investment in rapid testing mobile units throughout LA, and we certainly saw a real increase with this cohort in regards to their use of that. We looked at alcohol misuse, which was including binge drinking, frequent use, which is at least 3 times a week, and frequent binge. It's interesting to note that for the Latino-Mexican descent cohort, they were more likely to report being binge drinkers, not necessarily frequent. We also looked at drug use, where this does not include marijuana use. The Latino-Mexican descent cohort fell kind of in the middle in regards to the level of use. There was no difference in regards to the sexual risk behavior between the groups, but what is interesting is to look at those that are falling into the single partner seroconcordant group. We did some qualitative work, and we certainly found that a lot of the young men experiment with concepts like negotiated safety, but don't have necessarily a really good understanding as to what goes into negotiated safety. Certainly something that the young men are experimenting with. And then here's some of the information about those that were involved in sex exchange, sexual assault, or involvement in the street economy, which could have included hustling and prostitution, selling things on the street, panhandling, etc. So we did a path analysis in which we wanted to see to what extent self-efficacy for talking about safer sex with partners would mediate some of the variables that other researchers have found to be important for Latino MSM. We also wanted to include as covariates some sociodemographic variables like age, where they lived, alcohol misuse and drug use, acculturation, religiosity was one of the independent variables, and racism as well as stress. Our outcome was the sexual risk behavior variable that I showed earlier, with the highest risk being those who either were in serodiscordant relationships or had multiple partners. And these are the results in the final model. What we found was that friend support and outness were both associated with increased or higher rates of self-efficacy for talking about safer sex with partners. If one's friends were perceived to be higher risk, that was associated with less of a sense of self-efficacy. Not surprisingly, the more life stressors that they were experiencing was directly related with sexual risk. Living at home was protective of sexual risk. And of course, the self-efficacy for talking about safer sex with partners was also protective against sexual risk. I think it's interesting to note that the friend support was something that was protective for this group only. When we look at the other samples, friend support was generally associated with increased risk, which was mostly driven by the fact that the networks were particularly risky. So you could feel very supported by a group of friends that is endorsing risky behaviors. It was also interesting to note that some of the variables that we expected to be really important in this analysis didn't really hold up. Community connectedness, connectedness to one's ethnic community or connectedness to the gay community, ended up not having any relationship. Neither did racism or religiosity as we got into the larger model. That's not to say that these aren't really important constructs and certainly could, you know, have influence. It could be a statement about our sample size, but nonetheless, I think was interesting. Again, life stressors were associated with greater risk, and these are some of the things I've already stated before. I think some of the implications for this, I think there's an opportunity to build on self-efficacy for discussing sex and risk reduction with partners, which should remain in interventions. I know that many interventions include this, and I think for Latino YMSN that seems to be very important. I think there's certainly a need to research and bring innovation around our services for how to, how to better support young men in coping with the different range of stressors that they might experience as they emerge into adulthood, outside of just this analysis, but for all of our analyses, the amount of stress that these young men experience is one of the strongest predictors of their risk across different risk behaviors. We'll be looking at this model with our longitudinal data. I'd hope to be able to share some of that today, but we just didn't have enough time with getting that data really set up. We had just more recently completed that data collection. But we'll be looking at how these variables hold up over time and how the change of those types of support, their networks change over time, and how that relates to some of their risk and protective behaviors. And that leads me to my acknowledgments. We're really appreciative of the young men who hung out with us in the study. And completed an incredibly long survey, and many who participated in our qualitative interviews. And so we're just, you know, hugely grateful to them. We're also very grateful to our community advisory board, who hung out with us also throughout the entire duration of the study and offered just valuable insight throughout the course of the study. Of course, NIDA for funding this. And also some acknowledgement to Macy's Passport that's given us some funds to further disseminate the study. And I actually have a little booklet I brought which talks about the study, the whole study and the entire sample, and share some findings from our baseline, as well as has a little DVD on that. I have one I can hand out today, and if people give me their cards, we'll be happy to send this out to them as well. This was just a dissemination product that we've developed. So thank you so much.
Okay, we now have time for some questions. Okay, well, we'll start here. Can you hear her question?
To whom?
Yeah, I mean, the issue around what people believe around infection is pretty intense, and there's a lot of work that has to be done in understanding and working with folks about, you know, traditional medicine and what the grandmother can do versus what medicine, you know, here in the States provide and that type of thing. We have fewer HIV-positive folks in the qualitative phase of this study. But we do know through just some of our other work that that's a big issue. Go ahead.
Is there just a cultural
right. But there's a lot of misconceptions, and we've found it with all the different Latino populations we've worked with around HIV, STDs, and infection.
You had a question of this gentleman here?
Just
for the panel, but it just struck me listening to you. Is there a disconnect here between your saying kind of there's a lot of work to be done, continue that, and then the switch to opt-out testing, which for many reasons, both good and perhaps not so good, but are kind of limiting the opportunities for that work to be done, especially in clinical or public health settings. I'm just wondering, are we kind of going down two roads at the same time, or is there a connection that I'm missing from late in the afternoon?
Anyone like to address that?
Could you clarify what opt-out testing?
Yeah. There's no need for post-test counseling and no need for pre-test counseling. It's just it's the bringing HIV testing into the norm of blood work.
Exactly.
Right.
So it will be offered in all clinical.
I can take a stab at that. I think the question you're asking is one of the critical questions that needs to be asked in the field. And that is that I can speak for myself, but I suspect my colleagues may agree, I don't think anyone in the United States currently has an identified plan for where prevention for MSM is going in the next 5 years. And so in the absence of a clear vision of where we should go, we fall back on doing what we've done. And we fall back on mainstreaming, and you find that different parts are going at different things, at different loggerheads, or not everything's that. So I think, put kindly, first of all, you know, I think you are asking the critical question. And then the question maybe that this group needs to wrestle with is, okay, are we content with that? Are we just going to live with that? Or is it time to take a look and say a lot's happened, particularly in the last 10 years? And maybe we need an entire new strategic plan. Not that we've really ever had one. But you can't have one.
Anyone else back there have a question? Well, I have a question. I have a question for Dr. Horvath. I wanted to ask you about, you were talking about the need for individuals to share or not share their HIV status. Could you comment on that? Are you implying that it isn't necessary to?
I mean, one of the things I just want to make clear, I'm not certainly suggesting that people don't share their HIV statuses with each other. But my concern is that, given how many persons in the United States don't actually know their HIV status, mm-hmm. it sort of goes back to sort of also basics of communication. Remember in your communication 101 class where you had the communicator, the message, and then the person who's being communicated to. There are so many ways that that can break down the communication about HIV mm-hmm. status, either being inaccurately told or inaccurately heard, that my concern is that people, and I think this happens a lot, people are really relying on that information mm-hmm. that their partner is providing to really guide their decisions yeah. around safer sex. And I think the evidence shows that that is not often a very reliable way to make those decisions. So that's why I think we really need to be emphasizing sort of explicit agreements to engage.
And to follow up, and I don't know if you did ask about this, but did the individuals tend to trust the reports that their partners or would-be partners provided?
We didn't. I mean, it's a great question, right? Yeah. How much do they really believe that? And then how much does that factor into their decisions? We didn't ask that, but it's a great question.
Okay. Anyone want to follow up on that issue? Dr. Russer, I wanted to ask you too about how that was. I really enjoyed watching your presentation, and I wondered how you developed these modules and what you incorporated into each of the modules. What went into that? Why did you choose the ones you did?
It's a mixture. I think my experience of developing online interventions is basically I've spent the last 5 years unlearning what people told me was true in my undergrad and postgrad. Undergrads and postgrads. It speaks to always having a critical eye. By that I mean, I think that where intervention development's going, you can follow two lines. You can come at this from the HIV prevention perspective, like, oh, wow, we've got the internet, we've got to get something up there. And if you go down that road, by the time you've done one or two, you get to the stage of saying, how are we going to keep the guys in there? Nobody wants to be there. And you basically come to a dead end. We came at it more from the e-learning perspective of saying, okay, what are we going to build that is so exciting that people can't resist being there? And we, in our usability lab testing, I mean, we literally watched a guy who was cursing us saying, why is he making us do this? Why do they keep on making us do this? I'll just go over here. Why am I here? What am I doing? I'll just go over here. And we watched him do 26 interventions while complaining, and we had nothing to do that. He only had to do two of them, so you could see. And so I think the next generation of interventions for HIV prevention needs to take far more seriously the science and the development of communication and online. So we did that, and through multidisciplinary research, we used the sexual health model and others to promote a comprehensive agenda that takes about 3 to 5 hours to go through, which is internet hours, which is the equivalent of about 18 to 24 offline hours of education.
Dr. Dadja, I've got one for you here. And that is, you know, you were talking about this notion of compulsivity. And do you think this is a clinical condition, or is just another way of pathologizing sexual behavior?
Well, Bonnie, with 6 minutes left,
you come up with an answer. First thing that comes to your mind.
First thing that comes to my mind is a margarita. No, I'm saying. I honestly, there's, again, a whole philosophical debate within sexuality research and now sexual health as to the sort of legitimacy or validity of sexual compulsivity or sexual addiction or hypersexuality or whatever we want to call it as a clinical condition. And I do feel that, you know, for a certain segment of the population, and probably a smaller segment of the population than, you know, sometimes classified as such, these really may be true issues that are true issues that people struggle with, and tools like the sexual compulsivity can help at least tap into that and, you know, get people moving in the right directions appropriately. But I do also empathize with the sort of other camp who feels that, you know, how many different ways can we pathologize people's sexual behaviors? How many ways, particularly with men who have sex with men, how many new acronyms can we come up with? How many, you know, letters can we reduce people to and beat them over the heads, you know, in an attempt to, you know, enforce public health, which is really nothing more than public morality and policing and social regulation of sexual desire. So I guess
okay, we can have a discussion about that.
Maybe you can see which direction I'm leaning in a little bit, okay. Although I like to be in the middle of most things. But I think that I really do think that with further evidence, you know, with such as we found with clear associations with sexual health outcomes like sexually transmitted infections, that there's something there, but I don't think we've quite figured out what it is yet. And that debate needs to continue. But thank you.
Any comments on that comment? Okay, well, I want to thank you all for being here, and I hope to see everybody at the 8 o'clock social tomorrow in this building in room 31B. So, again, thank you, and thank you to our wonderful panel.
Thank you. I'd like to be too.
I'm in a row.
Okay, well, thank you.
Oh, yeah? Uh-huh.
Well, come and get me.
So I think I actually think for us.
Oh, did they bring me those books?
Thank you. You are the culture that loves us even more than the Americans.
Sure, I'm putting that on.
Yeah.